Good evening. It's Carol Murphy once again with Heartstock Radio. And this evening, I have some exciting news. There's been a little change in our schedule. I like to say that because it happens all the time in the world of dentistry, and that's a nice way of saying, oh my gosh, we're sitting here twiddling our thumbs. But in this case, it doesn't apply. We're actually changing to a new day of the week. We're going to be moving to Fridays at 4. I'm pretty excited about that. I think it's going to be a good switch. All in all, rather than the middle of the week, we'll be at the end of the week and a better time slot, I think. So next time you'll be hearing my voice a couple weeks from now, because I'm going on a little journey to Oakland. A couple weeks from now, we will be on Friday, and I look forward to that. But for tonight, our guest is Pete Gombert, and he's the CEO of Goodwell. And I'm sure you're wondering what that is. He's going to be back in just a moment and tell us all about it. He's from Boise, Idaho, and lots to talk about. We'll be back shortly. Thanks for tuning in.
This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Thanks for tuning in. This is Carol Murphy, and you're listening to Heartstock Radio. Hello, Pete.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being on Heartstock. So many things to talk about. My goodness. There was just this huge wealth of information about what all of the pots that you have your fingers in. What are you up to in Boise, Idaho? Tell our listeners, please.
Sure. First of all, pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on the show. So I have been a lifelong entrepreneur. I graduated from Villanova University with an accounting degree. And I went to Villanova because in high school, I did a little bit of research to find out what the greatest percentage of the CEOs in the country had with regards to their undergraduate degree. And I found out it was an accounting degree. And so I wanted to be a leader within corporate organizations for a long time. I went and got that degree. I worked for Arthur Andersen for about 3 years. And then six of us left and we started our own firm. And that was about 22 years ago. Since then, I've started and grown three technology companies and sold all three successfully. And my most recent sale happening in October of 2016. So I'm in the very fortunate position of being able to work on the things that really interest me and things that I really care about. So as of today, I'm working on six different companies that span anywhere from sort of creating very fair, equitable, and humane workplaces, that's Goodwell, all the way through to probably the most far afield is building affordable housing out of decommissioned shipping containers. So it's a wide swath of projects that I'm working on, but all are really focused on some component of social good. That's where I've spent probably about the last 8 years of my career, and it's where my heart lies and the things that I'm deeply interested in working on at this point in my career.
So just out of curiosity, what are the other four projects? You gave us two of them.
Sure. So the other four are involved with a company called Wisdom Labs down in San Francisco, which is focused on bringing mindfulness into the workplace. I am involved in a company here in Boise that is trying to bring blockchain to technology into organizations that traditionally wouldn't have access to that technology, called Uledger.
Sorry to pause you, but
sure.
For our listeners, can you explain what you mean by blockchain?
So blockchain is the technology that underlies something probably the listeners are a little bit more familiar with, which is Bitcoin. So it is essentially what they call an immutable ledger, which means that you can't change it once something is recorded. And that means the technology is broadly applicable to any environment in which you want to have a record of what happened that can never be changed. Mm. So you can imagine there's a lot of things from real estate to banking to currency where that might be applicable.
Excellent. Okay, so we have mindfulness and...
We have mindfulness, blockchain, Goodwill, IndieDwell, which is the affordable housing company that I mentioned. Then there's a company called Family Penny, which is helping parents and kids to work through family finances with the goal really of getting kids more educated, more financially literate through things that are very relevant to them. It's kind of a new way for parents and kids to work through allowance and loans and credit and savings and really just give kids the ability to start to understand basic principles of financial management. And then the last company is a tangent to Goodwill. It's called Actionable Insight. And that leverages something called Employee Net Promoter Score. Net Promoter Score was developed by Bain & Company to help measure customer loyalty. And we've modified that to help measure employee engagement. And then we use some machine learning to be able to read through kind of the feedback that employees give and be able to quantify that for leaders to understand where and how they can improve their organizations.
So you're in this unique position that, I don't know, so many people would just fantasize about of being able to do only things that you really are passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
How do you narrow it down to just these six?
That's really, really hard. It is, it's a challenge, to be honest. I love engaging with people that are trying to challenge the status quo and create something new. And it's very hard for me to say no. And so I've set some guidelines that help me to be able to determine whether I can actively pursue any opportunities that come my way. And they're fairly simple. The main goals of what I'm working on now is I want to work with people that I really enjoy working with. And I meet lots of entrepreneurs that are super passionate about what they're doing, but for whatever reason, they're not necessarily people that I would want to spend a lot of time with. And so that easily weeds out some portion of people that I end up speaking with. But the other thing, and probably the more important thing, is I'm really, really committed to using this sort of season of my career to try to do things that are purpose-driven and have some social component to what the mission of the company is. So with those two criteria set, it's become much easier for me to narrow things down. Now, out of the six things that I'm working on right now, four of them are things that I either started alone or co-founded. And so I still like to work on things that I think about a lot too. And that inherently limits me somewhat because I only have so many ideas.
And what's at the forefront of your ideas stream right now? And maybe you can weave that into a discussion of Goodwill and how you founded that or why you founded it.
Sure. Goodwill definitely sits at the top of my mind on a daily basis. Essentially, the story behind Goodwill is as I mentioned, started and run three businesses and of different sizes in different industries prior to the six that I just described. And I grew up in a very conservative household with a very individualistic mindset. And early on in my sort of development and through college and early on in my career, I was very, very focused on the mindset of creating wealth and creating shareholder value as being the maximum of what I could do with my career, with the intent that if I was successful enough to be able to create a lot of material wealth or economic wealth, I would give a lot of it away and be generous later in my life. And that was the mindset that drove me, and I did quite well using that mindset, again, very individualistically. But in my third company, I started and sold my first two companies within 3 years each. So they were very quick exits from a scale as compared to what happens today. The third company I thought was going to be 3 or maybe 5 years. It ended up being 12 years. And the reason that it was 12 years was largely attributed, in my mind anyway, to it running headlong into the Great Recession. So as we were scratching and clawing and trying to make it through the Great Recession, really all you do at that point is put your head down and try to get to tomorrow. And you're not looking up at the big picture whatsoever. So by mid-2009, I knew that we were going to still be around as an entity and was able to take a deep breath. And it kind of all hit me as a ton of bricks that, you know, there was maybe a little bit more to what I was considering as important in life. And, you know, call it a midlife crisis, even though I was relatively young, I think it was around 35 at the time, I still had this very significant weight on my shoulders that I should be doing something more important. And at that time, President Obama, the first thing that Obama signed into law was the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Repatriation Act. And so there were quite a few articles about gender pay gaps. And again, with my sort of conservative mindset, I thought it was just liberal propaganda. And yet at the same time, I have this accounting degree and a very curious mind. And so I decided that I was going to run the numbers and find out if we had a pay gap in my company. And the first thing I did, because again, I'm an accountant by training, is I went out to find the methodology that we would use to be able to normalize all the data. And I was shocked to find that there was no generally accepted methodology with regards to measuring pay gaps within companies. You know, the data that we hear about gender-based pay gaps or racial pay gaps tends to be macroeconomic data, not sort of micro-level data that you could use within an organization. So that surprised me, and sent me down a rabbit hole, and I did a whole bunch more research and ended up having to develop my own methodology in order to be able to run the numbers. And then I did run the numbers, and I was quite disheartened to find out that we had a gender pay gap in just about every position that we had within the organization.
So at that point, did you ask yourself why?
Yeah, well, it was particularly disheartening because I had hired and negotiated the salaries of every person in the organization. So if there was a reason, the reason sort of started with me. Mm. And I still to this day don't know how that happened, you know, whether I have some unintentional bias or whether, you know, the people that I was negotiating with didn't have the appropriate skills. I don't know why. The thing that struck me kind of like a lightning bolt, was that I had the intentionality to be a good employer, but my actions didn't follow that intentionality. And so what that led me to was creating a series of metrics, hard numbers that I could look at on a regular basis to ensure that my actions and intentions were aligned.
Well, I wonder too, do you think that maybe some of it comes from, this is going to maybe raise the hair on the back of some people's necks, but being a woman, what I've noticed in hiring is that women tend to ask for less.
Yes, it's well documented now that I've spent a long time in the space. That is generally accepted as a reason why some of these gaps exist. There are a lot of different reasons that people point to, but that is definitely a commonly accepted reason. And the point is that I believe most employers don't go into or operate in their role with the intention of being discriminatory. It's illegal to be discriminatory. But I think even beyond it being illegal, most people would say, most executives that I speak with, and I speak with a lot of them, don't want to behave that way. But there still, to this day, does not exist a commonly accepted methodology for measuring this. And therefore, you know, it goes back to the adage that you can't manage what you don't measure. And so Goodwell really tended to be a workplace framework to help management ensure that they are acting in alignment with their values and to create a framework that allows for continuous improvement and a demonstrable third-party certifications that allows them to demonstrate to their employees and to potential employees that they are indeed acting in alignment with their values. And so far, we've received a tremendous reception in the marketplace. There really isn't anything else that is working in this way. And from what we hear from leaders, generally, they're very, very appreciative of the fact that they have this tool set at their hand.
Okay, so we're going to take a brief break here. We'll be right back.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream Wars, this land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Thanks for listening. This is Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy. And just in case you missed it at the beginning, we're going to be changing our time slot to Fridays at 4. This evening, however, we're speaking with Pete Gombert. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
And this is really, really interesting stuff. I think it's interesting, some of the points that you already brought out, that there's really no way of measuring this data within companies. And I think it's true, just like what you were sharing before, is that many companies think they're doing a really good job, but then when you start looking at the numbers, it just does not pan out. So talk a little bit more about your experience and the company that you were at the helm of when you came to this realization about equitable pay.
Yeah. So I was at the CEO, the founder and CEO of a company called Ballyhoo, and we were a software company focused on marketing automation. And, you know, technology is a obviously a rapidly growing space, but it's one that's also well known to be very male dominated. And we were very good about having a significant mix of diversity in our organization. So that was good. It was easier to see than measuring a pay gap, because you could literally see if you had different genders, if you had different races within the organization. And so that was easier for us to tell that we were acting in alignment with our intention, but pay gap was not. And just to be clear, there are good ways to be able to measure pay gaps. They're just not generally accepted. There is no standard that is out there that is generally accepted by companies to go through. So, for example, Citigroup just announced that they have no pay gap issue. And that is great, except they don't say how they measured whether they have a pay gap or not. They don't release their methodology to say how they determined that they have no pay gap.
Not very transparent.
Not very transparent. Salesforce.com measured and raised their hand and said, hey, we've got a pay gap. It's $3 million, and we're going to raise the salaries of the women that we need to in order to close that pay gap. They did that in 2015. In 2017, they ran the numbers again, and they found out that they needed to raise another $3 million worth of salaries in order to close that gap. Again, great work. Applaud Mark Benioff and the group there for doing their work, but they're not releasing how they're measuring it. So it's impossible to tell if their methodology is appropriate or not. And, you know, the fact that they had another $3 million in pay gaps accrue over the course of a relatively short period of time, 2 years, says that they don't have the right processes in place to ensure that they are not creating these problems. And so that is that's something that we're trying to rectify. We just recently launched an initiative called Mind the Gap, which is an offering to all companies who have gone through the hard work of measuring pay gaps to join together, submit confidentially in their methodologies, so that we can compile and compare those methodologies and convene a working group in hopes of creating a generally accepted methodology for measuring pay gaps.
Well, isn't that kind of one of the inherent problems with pay and pay gap and measuring it? Is it's considered confidential information, and companies kind of like to keep it that way.
Well, yes, to a certain degree, although all of the work that we do is completely confidential anyway. But I think the bigger risk is that it is illegal to pay people differently for the same work. And so most organizations don't want to sort of expose their liability by actually measuring it. The law basically was passed in 1963, states that you cannot pay people differently for the same work. But what it doesn't do is define how that is measured. And so any variable that you want to throw in can be included. And so in the reason for creating that discrepancy. And so what most people point to is performance. You know, this person performs better than this person, therefore I'm going to pay them differently. And that's fine, but there should be a standard methodology that allows companies to understand where those gaps exist, and then to dive in and say, yes, there is a performance issue here, or there is some other reason as to why we're paying people differently for the same work. And that just doesn't, there is no commonly accepted methodology. But I think it is a legal reason as to why companies don't want to measure this.
And costly, because they have to fix it. So what are you going to do?
Right.
Decrease the pay of those who are making more? No, probably not. Have to pay ones you're not paying enough more. So
that's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
So we've got about 2 minutes left. Can you tell us in a brief synopsis kind of way, how do you measure it accurately?
Yeah, there are only certain variables that you can control for. And so we try to do is, and the methodology that we use accommodates for geography, because paying people in India the same thing that you're going to pay people in San Francisco doesn't make sense. So we account for geography, and then we account for tenure and role, because as you can imagine, if you've got somebody that's been in a role for 20 years, and a person that's just started in that role and they're doing the same work, you are going to pay the person that's been in the role for 20 years more than you pay the person that's just started. So those are the two major factors that you account for using the methodology. And then once you run the numbers through those two major factors, then you can start to understand where the discrepancies are and why they might exist. But those are the major ones that you want to account for and normalize the data to ensure that location and tenure and role are not coming into play.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.
From the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream wars, this land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of a diamond dance. And all around me, a voice was sounding. This land was made for you and me. Oh, when the sun came shining, and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. As the fog was lifting, a voice was chanting. This land was made for you and me. And as I went walking, I saw a sign there. And on the sign it said no trespassing. But on the other side, in the shadow of the steeple, I saw my people. By the relief office, I see my people as they stood there.